Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Thursday, March 7th, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Looking at the front page of the Globe Gazette, big story, Sharing the Love. And it shows a photo of a woman from Molly's Mission sitting alongside big bags of pet food and kitty litter that she has collected as part of the Molly's Mission. And the second story on the front page is Mason City's Brinkley goes to D.C. with Representative Henson. And we'll start with that story. Police chief at State of the Union speech tonight. This is from Jacob Schaefer of the Globe Gazette. Mason City Police Chief Jeff Brinkley is in Washington, D.C. this week after being invited to be U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson's guest for President Biden's State of the Union address tonight. Hinson, a Republican who represents Iowa's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Mason City, Waterloo, and Cedar Rapids, invited Brinkley to the nation's capital to share his views on immigration and safety issues involving the country's southern border as reflected in Iowa. Brinkley said his invitation to join the Congresswoman in Washington came as a surprise, and he was honored to accept. "I've never thought I'd be here for this," Brinkley said. "It's important for us to speak truthfully to power." Having arrived in the Capitol on Tuesday, Brinkley said he's been able to sit down with Hinson, talk over issues, and see what she's doing in the party. Hinson, who represents 22 Iowa counties, said her top priorities are supporting law enforcement and securing the nation's southern border. She said the opportunity to bring Brinkley to the State of the Union address is an honor. "For me, it's really important to highlight my constituents who are doing good work," she said. "Public safety is at the front of the minds for people in my district." Apart from going to the District of Columbia, representing North Iowa and Mason City, Brinkley said he'll come back to his post ready to share the messages he's received and continue the conversation. "I want to bring back the encouragement to our men and women in law enforcement that there is support from many different levels," Brinkley said. "It takes a team effort." And then it shows a photo, a headshot of Mr. Brinkley. Next story. Here's the story that accompanies the photo of the woman sitting next to the dog food. Molly's Mission continues its journey helping pets across North Iowa. Molly is a joyful corgi with a heart full of love. She's also a certified therapy dog and the face of Molly's Mission, which is a local nonprofit dedicated to help North Iowans in need to care for their pets. Molly has a way of knowing when someone needs a gentle nuzzle or a small, warm cuddle. She visits senior care centers, preschools, and those who may just need a pick-me-up, along with her devoted owner, Linda Symes. That's S-I-E-M-S. And Symes has a way of knowing that sometimes pet owners need a hand when it comes to caring for their fur babies, which is why she established the organization in 2019. She realized how difficult it can be to make financial choices that benefit both owner and pet, and didn't want anyone to feel they were letting their companions down. Now, Molly's Mission offers food, fostering, and friends as its core mission. The organization also offers fostering for veterans who've been deployed, folks undergoing surgery, or those who just need to take time to care for themselves. Molly's Mission believes that no one should have to sacrifice the comfort and love of a companion animal due to unforeseen circumstances. Molly's Mission works closely with social service agencies such as Elderbridge, Prairie Ridge, and North Iowa Community Action to reach people in need. To qualify for pet food, a resident needs to have a referral from a local service agency or receive federal benefits such as Social Security Disability Insurance, Veterans Benefits, SNAP eligibility may or may not qualify people for Molly's Mission. Currently, Molly the Corgi is competing for the title of America's Favorite Pet. Winners of that contest will be featured on the cover of Modern Dog or Modern Cat magazine and receive a $10,000 prize. First round voting ends at 7 p.m. on March 7th, so that's today. Symes said the prize money would be a boon to the local nonprofit, which takes in as many as 100 requests each month. We're able to fulfill about 75% of those. We're lucky to have Target, Fleet Farm, and Tractor Supply as suppliers. They've been really great to us, she said. About 95% of the mission's clients are returning. A majority of these people will likely be with us until their pets pass, she said. The organization also offers training classes for puppies and beginners. More advanced classes for agility and rally are also available. Rally is an opportunity to work side by side with a dog on varying skills, and agility is a competition in which dogs must navigate an obstacle course. Molly's mission uses monetary donations to purchase nutritious food for pets. Many donors choose to have pet food, shipped directly from online retailers to the charity for the sake of ease. We love getting those big deliveries from UPS, even if the UPS man doesn't like how heavy they are, said Symes with a smile. Now, through the end of April, anyone can donate to the Power of One campaign. The campaign was founded to raise money to refurbish the Quonset building located at 500 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City. Kim Plegancool, owner of the location, has arranged for Symes to use the space for storage and distribution. We need heat and lighting to get it in shape for use, said Symes. $1 at a time can become 10. 10 can become 100, and 100 can become 1,000. Individuals can apply for pet food for up to 2 animals online, and their website is mollysmission.com. And turning to the next page, House GOP passes bill to ban guaranteed income. Dateline Des Moines. A pilot program to study the effects of a monthly basic income may be the last in Iowa after House Republicans passed a bill to ban guaranteed income programs by counties and cities in the state. House File 2319 would ban cities and counties from implementing programs that provide regular cash payments to individuals that are quote-unquote unearned and that may be used for any purpose. The bill passed the House 55-43, largely along party lines. 7 Republicans joined all Democrats in voting no. It's now eligible for consideration in the Senate. Republican Representative Steve Holt of Denison, who proposed the bill, said on Monday guaranteed income programs would hurt the state's labor force and discourage work ethic among people receiving the payments. He said government money is better used on targeted aid programs like Medicaid and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Quote, in the end, I believe these programs will increase government dependency and poverty, as opposed to independence and prosperity, he said. It would appear to me, he continued, that the goal of these pilot programs seems to be to lay the groundwork for a massive expansion of guaranteed income programs, unquote. Uplift Iowa, a project involving 4 central Iowa local governments and a number of businesses and nonprofits, is the only existing guaranteed income program in the state. The pilot program provides 110 central Iowa residents with monthly payments of $500 that can be spent without restriction. The program was set up to research the effects of regular monthly payments to low-income people. It also uses a combination of public funding and donations by businesses and nonprofits. The program uses no state tax dollars, but it does use federal pandemic relief dollars awarded to Des Moines and Urbandale. Uplift Iowa is set to last 2 years, ending in spring of 2026. Under the bill, the project would be allowed to continue, but no future guaranteed income programs could be started. There are around 30 other similar programs across the U.S., according to the Guaranteed Income Pilots Dashboard. The Iowa Association of Counties is registered opposed to the bill, along with a number of public health organizations. Tax relief organizations are registered in favor of the bill. Democrats said the bill is an attack on local control and would take away an option for cities and counties to help Iowa families in need. Representative Beth Wessel Kroschel, a Democrat from Ames, said $500 is not enough money to cause someone to quit their job, and that it can be used to buy school supplies, stable housing, or other means to ease a family's financial struggles or get out of poverty. Quote, "This bill is nothing but a roadblock," she said. "It removes local control, and it's one more attempt to ensure that struggling Iowans continue to struggle." Democrats also questioned the need for the bill when low-income Iowans struggle to afford housing, childcare, and other necessities. "What's the purpose of this?" said Representative Monica Kurth, a Democrat from Davenport. "Why does this bill want to further take money away from those families that are working so hard to make ends meet?" And in brief, city approves Mason City Police Department pay increase. The Mason City Council has approved a 3.5% across-the-board wage increase for the Teamsters Local Union 238. Local 238 is made up mainly of Mason City's police force. The increase begins in March and was implemented to bring pay for the Teamsters 238 on par with the remainder of the city workforce. The current agreement covers 2020 to 2025. The Teamsters have agreed to the increase, as well as a 3% increase scheduled for the final year of the contract, which is effective July 1. The city and the union will undergo negotiations in the near future for a new contract. Our next in brief, Clear Lake voters approve levy in special election. Clear Lake Community School District voters approved a physical plant and equipment levy in a special election on Tuesday. The Cerro Gordo County Auditor reported that just 275 people voted. That's a 4.2% voter turnout rate, with 166 voting in favor, 109 against the public measure, according to the unofficial results. 60% voted in favor, which required 50% approval to pass. The $1.34 per $1,000 in taxable valuation levy was set to expire in June, but has now been extended for another 10 years. PPEL funds can be used for a number of projects and items, including technical and safety equipment and maintenance and repair. Turning to the state page, Biden easily wins Iowa Dems' first mail-in caucus. President Joe Biden easily won the Iowa Democratic mail-in caucus on Tuesday, winning a vote of confidence from the state's Democrats in the first contest, since the state was booted from the first spot in the party's nominating calendar. As the last votes were being tabulated at the party headquarters Tuesday morning, Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart said this year's all-mail contest was the result of years of work by the state party. "I've been the chair here at the Iowa Democratic Party for a little over a year now, but this process started before I did," she said. "So this is the final culmination of seeing who the Democrats in Iowa are choosing to be their nominee for president." Biden won 91% of the votes, according to unofficial results announced by the party Tuesday night. Marianne Williamson, a self-help author, received 2%, while U.S. Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota received 3%. 4% cast their vote as, quote, uncommitted. While neither long-shot challenger received the minimum threshold of 15% of the votes, Biden will be awarded all of the state's 46 delegates to the Democratic National Convention. In total, 12,193 Iowa Democrats returned presidential preference cards in Iowa Democrats' first run at the new process as of Tuesday afternoon. The results from Iowa, one of 16 states and territories to hold a Democratic contest on Super Tuesday, came without the frenzy and media attention that usually accompanies the Iowa caucuses. Instead of voters scrambling into corners in crowded school gyms and complicated caucus math, the vote counting took place in a small room in a nondescript Des Moines office building. The party contracted with a team led by Amber McReynolds, who is the founding CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute, to oversee the voting and tabulation process. The state party was forced to reinvent its nominating process after the Democratic National Committee removed Iowa from its decades-old position at the front of the presidential primary calendar. After a botched results process in the 2020 Iowa Democratic caucuses, The Democratic National Committee moved to reorder the nominating calendar in an effort to elevate the voices of people of color and encourage primaries over caucuses. The National Party promoted South Carolina to the top spot, awarding the state that gave a kickstart to Biden's 2020 campaign. While Iowa Democrats held party organizing caucuses in January, the same day as the Republicans' first-in-the-nation presidential caucuses, the new calendar meant they could not tally votes until after the other early states had voted. Democrats have long had concerns about the accessibility of the Iowa caucuses, which requires voters to go to a caucus site for hours on a winter evening. Critics say the caucuses are inaccessible for people who work nights, have disabilities, or leave the state in the winter. In contrast to those in-person caucuses, Hart said this year's contest is the most accessible in the party's history. All registered Democrats in the state had the option to request a presidential preference card. Quote, "This is the first time that in Iowa, when you work third shift or when you have small children and you don't have childcare in the evenings, you still got to have your voice heard," Hart said. "People still participated in this process." The Iowa Democratic Party received 19,609 caucus card requests and cards postmarked by Tuesday. If they were postmarked by Tuesday, they can be counted if they arrive to the party's headquarters by Friday. The party will certify the official results tally March 16, Hart said. The number of returned caucus cards so far falls short of the number of people who participated in the party's 2012 caucus. That's the last time an incumbent Democrat was on the presidential ballot. And it's just a fraction of the more than 200,000 people who participated in the competitive 2008 caucuses, which catapulted former President Barack Obama's campaign. Around 110,000 Republicans participated in the party's caucus this year, where there was a competitive presidential contest. In a statement on Tuesday, Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman said Iowa Democrats' pivot to the mail-in system was an attempt to appease National Party leaders, over the interests of Iowans. Quote, "The Iowa GOP caucus held in January was a lively, grassroots-driven, transparent model of democracy," Kaufman said. "Preserving Iowa's first-in-the-nation status ensures that literally anyone can be president. Now more than ever, it's important that those who want to run our country are not just crowned by the establishment, but rather that the grassroots of each party decide who their nominee should be," unquote. The caucuses have long served as a tool for party organizing, as candidates have flooded the state with money and media attention during competitive years, driving voter registration and turnout at the caucuses. But without that draw, Iowa's Democrats face an organizing challenge compounding their waning competitiveness in state elections. Hart said the party is examining how it can encourage voters, under the new process, to turn out for the in-person caucuses and engage them to show up on Election Day. "Iowa Democrats have a long ways to go," Hart said. "We've talked in the past about how we're reimagining these in-person caucuses now, and I think that that is exactly the way to look at it," she said. "It's different. It's a new process. So we've got to figure out how to create more interest around that, how to get better participation at the in-person caucus, just like we're looking at the way to tweak the mail-in process," she said. Our next story, district sued over teacher's sexual abuse of a student. A federal lawsuit has been filed against the East Sac County Community School District by the mother of a student who was sexually abused by a teacher. The lawsuit, filed on behalf of a woman identified in court papers as Jane Roe and her son, John Doe, names the school district Superintendent Jeffrey Cruz and East Sac County High School Principal Kevin Litterer as defendants. The court petition is based on what it calls a shocking and egregious case of sexual assault, harassment, abuse, and exploitation of a minor student, said by Stephanie Regine Kelsey, who was a special education teacher at the time of the abuse. Kelsey is currently serving a 10-year prison sentence for this abuse. According to the lawsuit, Kelsey's classroom at the high school was located on the third floor of the building where there were no video cameras. Her classroom had a lock on the door, and the window on the door had been completely covered with cardboard and paper. The lawsuit alleges that during the 2021-22 school year, Doe, who was a 14-year-old freshman and not a special education student, was frequently absent from class that he was scheduled to attend. Those absences were the result of Doe meeting Kelsey in her classroom, where the two engaged in sex on several occasions, the lawsuit alleges. Quote, no school official ever searched for him or followed up with him or his classroom teachers about where he was or what he was doing, the lawsuit claims. Sometime in December of 2021, Kelsey began sending dozens of nude photos of herself to Doe, the lawsuit alleges. At one point, she pulled Doe into her classroom and kissed him, the petition states. Other students observed full frontal, lengthy hugs by the two, and they saw Kelsey putting her head on Doe's shoulder, the lawsuit claims. The petition alleges that from December 2021 through the first week of March of 2022, the two engaged in sex 1 to 3 times a week, with at least 5 such incidents taking place inside Kelsey's locked classroom. Kelsey prepared a paper record of their activities, labeled it K and S, and marked her desk calendar with hearts for each time they had sex. And both items were openly displayed on her desk during school hours, the lawsuit claims. Mark Jansma, a member of East Sac County's school board at the time, was also a police officer during the 2021-22 school year, and, according to the lawsuit, was told by his daughter, a student in the district, about rumors that Doe and Kelsey were having sex. Jansma advised his daughter that nothing could be done without concrete proof, the lawsuit alleges. In addition, the lawsuit claims that Kelsey's teaching aide, Alexis Lights, overheard students talking about nude photos Kelsey had sent to Doe. And although she reportedly asked Kelsey about the rumors, she did not report them. In January and February of 2022, the lawsuit claims, at least two parents called school officials about the growing rumors of a sexual relationship between Kelsey and Doe. Litterer and Cruz spoke to Kelsey in January or February about the rumors, which Kelsey denied, the lawsuit states. Jane Roe learned of the rumors from the mother of one of her son's friends, according to the lawsuit, and contacted the school. The petition alleges that on March 9, Litterer called Roe and left a voicemail stating, "We know Stephanie and Doe have a special relationship." The same day, the mother who informed Roe of the rumors examined her son's phone and found messages suggesting Doe was having sex with Kelsey, the lawsuit claims. She sent screenshots of the messages to Doe's mother, who then went to the Sac County Sheriff's Department to report her concerns, according to the lawsuit. The next day, the lawsuit claims, Doe told authorities he and Kelsey had engaged in sexual intercourse several times in her classroom and other locations away from school. When questioned, the lawsuit alleges, Kelsey confessed to the sexual activity and to sending the teenager nude photos via Snapchat and through text messages. She was immediately arrested and charged with 3 counts of sexual abuse in the third degree. Court records indicate that a few weeks later, the case was amended to include 8 counts of sexual abuse and 1 count of sexual exploitation. In February of 2023, Kelsey pleaded guilty to sexual abuse in the third degree and sexual exploitation by a school employee and was sentenced to prison for a term of no more than 10 years. The lawsuit alleges that in the wake of the arrest, the Sac County community became a hostile environment for Doe and his mother, with the teenager being called names while out in public. As part of her lawsuit, Roe alleges that she was at a county fair when she mentioned to others her need to check in with her son. When she mentioned to others her need to check in with her son, she was advised that he was, quote, probably off effing with a teacher, unquote. In the petition, Roe alleges She now goes out of town to buy groceries, does not attend community events, and limits all her interactions with community members. According to the lawsuit, Kelsey's husband harassed Doe's family to such an extent that a civil restraining order was issued by the court. The lawsuit seeks unspecified damages for violations of Doe's constitutional rights, negligence, breach of fiduciary duty, emotional distress, loss of consortium, and negligent supervision. The lawsuit was originally filed in state court before being filed this week in federal court. The defendants have yet to file a response. Now it's time to turn to obituaries. Larry Eugene Schweiger, age 85, died Saturday, March 2nd at Mercy One Medical Center in Mason City. A graveside service will be held March 9, 11:30 a.m. at Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City, with Mark Doble officiating. Michael Buck Perkins passed away unexpectedly February 28th at his home in Culpeper, Virginia. He was born in Sioux City. Celebration of Life will take place in Culpeper on Thursday, today, March 7th. Richard Pat James Von Bank, 87 years old, of Clear Lake, died peacefully in his home Sunday, March 3rd. Funeral mass will happen Monday, March 11, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Clear Lake at 10:30 a.m. Burial will take place at the Clear Lake Cemetery. Visitation Sunday, March 10, at the Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel in Clear Lake from 4 to 6 p.m. with a scriptural wake service happening at 6 p.m. followed by a fourth degree Knights of Columbus rosary and service. Turning to the opinion page in the Globe Gazette, the political cartoon's pretty good today. It shows two figures dressed up as Superman. One of them is clearly Joe Biden, and he has fallen. They're standing in front of an entrance to a building, and Joe Biden has fallen and is flat on his face. And the one representing Donald Trump is splat up against the side of the building. The two people standing, two more people are standing next to the building, and one of them has a thought bubble that says he tripped over the curb. The other person is saying, are they wearing Depends? And then the thought bubble coming out of the Donald Trump figure says, it's the building's fault, election interference. So here we have a opinion from the Chicago Tribune, another view, and it reads, court liberals help Trump and America. Unanimous ruling returning former president to ballot knocks down deep state claims. We were not surprised that the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday ruled that individual states cannot unilaterally bar former President Donald Trump from appearing on ballots on the grounds of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the part of the Constitution that bars prior insurrectionists from holding office. When it comes to federal offices, it's pretty clear that the framers saw the application or disabling of that amendment as the responsibility of Congress. States certainly have the authority to bar their own state officials on those grounds, which is well and good. But having some states allow Trump's name to stand on a ballot for President of the United States and others bar him on a patchwork basis clearly would have produced a chaotic result, given that what happens in one state would of course impact the other 49. And any reasonable person can see that that partisan tit-for-tat would have been the inevitable consequence. This was always a Hail Mary on the part of those who believe that Trump's odious actions on that rightly notorious January 6th were those of an insurrectionist and thus disqualifying him or disqualifying in his current presidential run. Illinois was among the states that gave it a shot. Most of those who supported this attempt, and we were never among them, likely had convinced themselves that the ends justified their means. It's tempting, but no cigar. But we were stirred and pleased that the Supremes acted unanimously in striking down the Colorado Supreme Court ruling, which was the issue on the table here, but will extend to other states that have followed suit. The three liberal justices stepped away from their potential partisan corners and also rejected the suggestions of several law professors, no doubt of their acquaintance. That puts this issue to bed in the best possible way, and Trump should return the favor by noting that not everything in Washington is some deep state plot against him. To his credit, he actually did take some baby steps Monday in that direction. When things go his way, he is capable of marginal magnanimity. It's when things do not that this big baby's ruinous side always reveals itself. In this case, he could learn a thing or two from those liberal justices. They swallowed hard and did their jobs. Trump for president is a matter for the voters, such as the price of democracy. And that was a view from the Chicago Tribune. Another opinion comes from Jeffrey Davich, who writes for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And it's called The Bald Truth About Hair, Horseshoes, Shaved Heads. The young schoolboy blurted out his first impression when I entered his classroom. "I like your hair," he exclaimed. I had no idea why he said this until a few seconds later. "My dad is bald," he said with a sigh. A few of his classmates giggled. I scribbled down his unsolicited observation for this column, which had been bouncing around my hairy head for nearly a month. Men's baldness is a topic I've never put much thought into. I recently learned why. I've been blessed to have a head of hair that grows like a chia pet submerged in holy water. I need a haircut every 3 to 4 weeks. Otherwise, I begin looking like that guy who has wild and crazy hair but doesn't know it. You know the guys I'm talking about. But bald? It never occurred to me what bald men go through, physically or psychologically. As soon as this topic landed on my radar, I began asking around to men with bald or shaved heads. Are they bald by choice or by genetics? How do they feel about it? "Bald is beautiful, baby," a work colleague told me. He was just talking to his barber about hair restoration promises, he said. I don't believe they're effective, despite the marketing. So why throw my money away for this might work, he said. I'm not vain enough to really care about something as silly as being bald. Not all bald men described it to me as something silly, though a few deflected my questions with jokes such as, "What do you call a bald man on a windy day?" "Fortunate." Larry David, the writer, actor, and comedian, doesn't feel as fortunate. When he accepted his Emmy Award in 1992 for Outstanding Writing in a Comedy Series for the classic Seinfeld episode, The Contest, he quipped, "This is all very well and good, but I'm still bald." Obviously, it doesn't bother him enough to get his hair restored like other high-profile celebrities such as TV sports announcer Joe Buck, who has undergone 8 and counting hair plug procedures. His addiction to these procedures cost him his voice for part of the 2011 season, caused by side effects of a hair transplant. A few years ago, just before I met former Chicago Bears superstar Brian Urlacher at a casino, a few co-workers reminded me to check out his newly restored hair. I did everything I could to not stare at it while I interviewed him, but I heard other people whispering about it. In the Chicago region, near where I live, dozens of billboards are still posted near major highways, showing images of Urlacher's new head of hair, compliments of RestoreHair.com. One states, "Welcome to O'Hare Hairport." Others state, "Hair Locker and Hall of Fame Hair and Urlacher 1, Balding 0. A work colleague of mine, who sports a shaved head, offers a more philosophical approach. "If my memory of studying evolution is accurate, human beings became less hairy as they advanced through the ages. So bald men are more evolved than men with great hair, it would seem," he said, noting that he's pretending to look like an NBA star rather than merely an old guy. Charles Barkley, The former NBA superstar, who's as bald as a basketball, recently said that nobody wants to be bald. "Everybody I know who's bald, we started going bald," he said. "We didn't want to go bald, we just started balding." Male pattern baldness matters more than I thought. The phrase hair restoration is often uttered in the same hushed tone as erectile dysfunction. To avoid it, most bald men I know intentionally keep their head shaved as a preemptive strike against the appearance of natural balding. Quote, "I never cared enough to do any treatments, and I never wanted to go through the reapplying of the products," one friend told me. "I shave by choice every day," another friend said. "I saw my dad's horseshoe on his head, and I promised that I would never have that." I had no idea that so many of my friends are bald. I guess I just didn't notice. I'm banking on artificial intelligence to someday restore my hair and rescue my love life, a social media friend told me. Another friend said he and four friends shaved their heads for the last day of high school. One friend used Nair and got a horrible rash. Another friend used a razor and had cuts everywhere. Another had a really lumpy head, he recalled. Mine, on the other hand, just looked so good that I kept it. I used a razor that day, and I still do to this day. I knew I had thin hair, and my day would come. Imagine all the money I've saved on shampoo over the years. Barkley disagrees. Everybody wants hair, he said. And that's from Jerry Davich of the the Times of Northwest Indiana. Way past the half point of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Thursday, March 7th, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Francis, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. You can catch podcasts of this and most of our local programs right there on our website, which is iowaradioreading.org. And now we'll turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger. First story. All Fort Dodge school employees to get bonuses. Employees of the Fort Dodge Community School District will be receiving some extra money in their March paychecks. The district's Board of Education approved bonuses for all the roughly 550 employees a couple of weeks ago. Full-time employees will receive $1,000. Part-time employees will receive bonuses based on the number of hours they work. "Our belief is that attracting and retaining staff is everything," said Stu Cochran, president of the school board. "Our motive is to try to raise morale. We figured March was a great opportunity to give them a little boost." District Superintendent Josh Porter said, "The bonuses are intended to, quote, give back to our staff. Obviously, staff was very thankful," he said. Porter said he thinks the bonuses will help with retaining and recruiting teachers, but he noted that all employees, bus drivers, paraeducators, secretaries, and support personnel, will receive bonuses. He said the bonuses will cost the district about $500,000, with the money coming from the general fund. "We did have money available for this purpose," Cochran said. Porter said in 2020, federal COVID relief money paid for staff bonuses, but this is the first time that the district paid for bonuses in this way. The big story on the front page of the Fort Dodge Messenger today, reading, singing, come together. Visiting author's show brings positive message to local students. And it shows a photo of author and musician Eric Litwin dancing with students at the Early Childhood Center in Fort Dodge Wednesday morning. Pete the Cat loves his white shoes. If you have any doubt about that, there's a bunch of Fort Dodge Community School District students who will fill you in on the important details. Those preschoolers, kindergartners, first graders, and second graders got the scoop on the fictional feline by spending some time Wednesday with the man who created him, author and musician Eric Litwin. But their time with the children's book writer wasn't just a story hour. It also involved singing and what Litwin called disco line dancing. The multi-purpose room at the Early Childhood Center was filled with young students for four performances. Pete the Cat is the star of the book Pete the Cat, I Love My White Shoes. Litwin wrote that book in 2008. It was his first book, and it launched a series of books about the cat. He wrote the first four. Other authors have taken over since. Some of his other books are about the Nut family, in which Dad is an acorn and his wife and children are other kinds of nuts. He also wrote a book called The Poop Song, which, rather than being a foray into gross-out humor, is intended to be an aid in potty training. "They come from my imagination," he said of his books before his 11 a.m. performance for Early Childhood Center students. "All of my books have positive messages," he said. "That's my inspiration, positivity." He's also written a nonfiction book for teachers called The Power of Joyful Reading. "My main message is that we can make reading fun," he said. Litwin also released 8 music CDs. The author, who lives in Washington, D.C., does hundreds of shows across the country. His local visit was courtesy of the Fort Dodge High School Alumni Association, which annually pays for a children's book author to visit. The first and second graders from Butler, Cooper, Duncombe, and Fieldhaver elementary schools were brought to the Early Childhood Center in school buses for their time with Litwin. Litwin, who describes himself as a recovering teacher, said his performances are reading theater that include repetition, rhyme, and musicality. And then there are 3 more photos. One shows a group of kindergartners filling the multi-purpose room, and many of them are wearing Pete the Cat hats. Another photo shows him standing there with a microphone, and then there's another photo of a selection of his books set out on display at the Early Childhood Center in Fort Dodge. Another story from the front page. Bill to have community college leaders create aid distribution formula moves. A bill handling the development of community college aid distribution formulas to community college leaders will head to the Iowa Senate floor after moving through committee. The Senate Appropriations Committee passed Senate File 2373, which would strike current code on the formula determining state funding allocations for each of the state's community colleges and form a council of community college presidents and chancellors to determine the formula on a yearly basis. As amended, the bill would have this president's council's As amended, the bill would have this president's council consider college enrollments, combined support, and other relevant factors when determining the formula. And no college will receive fewer allocated funds than in previous years unless the base funding allocation itself had been reduced, said Senator Tim Kreyenbrink, a Republican of Fort Dodge. At least 10 of the 15 community college leaders would need to approve the formula for it to head to the Department of Education for implementation, according to the bill. And if a consensus cannot be reached by October 31st each year, the department will determine the formula instead. Kreyenbrink said during the committee meeting that the bill came to lawmakers from the community colleges and schools that could see either increases or decreases in appropriations are fully backing it. Quote, "The neat thing is that all 15 of the college presidents and chancellors voted 100% to support this, and very rarely do you get 100% of anybody that's on a winning or losing side to support something that they believe in so much. And I think with the newness of a lot of our presidents and chancellors and community colleges, I think that they saw something that needed to be addressed," Kreyenbrink said. Senator Cindy Winkler, Democrat of Davenport, reiterated concerns she had previously expressed in subcommittee meetings about how students currently enrolled in high school and college courses would factor into the formula, as they are counted in community college enrollment for funding, but the money those programs generate comes through K-12 channels. She said she'd like to see concurrent programming represented in combined support when creating the formula, and that lawmakers continue to have access to breakdowns of how much funding each college would see under the new formula each year to be informed during the budgeting process. Kreienbrink said they should be able to cover those concerns as the bill moves ahead. Updating the distribution formula and giving it more flexibility year over year was one of the community college's system's priorities for this legislative session, said Indian Hills Community College President Matt Thompson. His college is one that has been weighted at a higher level than others with the current funding formula, he said, and the goal of these changes is to provide more equity across the board. Thompson said the community colleges are seeking a $10 million increase in state aid this year. That's higher than in past sessions, in order to more quickly reach an equilibrium. Half of the funds would go to helping this balance, and the rest would be put into maintaining programs and handling higher costs. Quote, "We have received really unanimous support through the presidents, through the work that we've done to try to determine a solution that helps all of us across the state of Iowa maintain the high-quality program that we offer our community colleges," he said. Our next story. Illegal immigration would be a state crime in Iowa under Senate bill. Iowa law enforcement would have the authority to arrest undocumented immigrants for entry into the state if they are in the United States illegally, under legislation passed Tuesday by the Iowa Senate. Senate File 2340, approved with a 34-16 vote, would make entry or being found in Iowa an aggravated misdemeanor if the person was denied admission, deported, or removed from the U.S., or if they have such an order outstanding. People removed from the country related to certain convictions could face felony charges under the bill. If arrested, state courts would be able to order the deportation of undocumented immigrants arrested in Iowa, and law enforcement and state agencies would be able to transport migrants to a port of entry to ensure they leave the country as ordered or face felony charges. Senator Janice Weiner, Democrat of Iowa City, asked the bill's floor manager, Senator Jeff Reichman, Republican of Montrose, how Iowa law enforcement would transport a person to a port of entry, a procedure, Reichman said, would be determined through the rulemaking process. Weiner criticized the provision for being either unrealistic or extremely expensive. Iowa has one port of entry, the Des Moines International Airport, which offers few international flights. Ensuring a person gets on a plane would likely not ensure that they leave the country, Weiner said. The other option of having law enforcement escort undocumented immigrants directly to the U.S.-Mexico border would require, quote, a standing unlimited appropriation, she said. Quote, "This bill is a political stunt and a false promise that doesn't contain the needed resources," she said. "It's a gotcha bill. But I have great news. There's a solution out there, colleagues. A tough, bipartisan compromise bill was hammered out in the U.S. Senate." Weiner called for lawmakers to contact Iowa's federal congressional delegation to support legislation on immigration, supported by Democrats and some Republicans like Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, that GOP senators rejected in February. Weiner also introduced a measure to allow abatement of prosecution in such cases if a person is under or eligible for a protective visa under the Federal Violence Against Women Act. Under the federal law, undocumented immigrants who have been trafficked can be issued protective visas when working with law enforcement to help capture traffickers and abusers. Weiner said the bill in its current form would remove protection for these groups and would remove incentives for victims to work with law enforcement to capture the, quote, worst actors in trafficking situations. Though Reichman pointed to provisions in the bill that prohibit law enforcement from arresting people in schools, churches, and facilities providing healthcare or forensic medical examination for sexual assault, Weiner argued that these provisions would not protect victims of trafficking. The amendment failed 17-33. In his closing comments, Reichman said President Joe Biden took an oath to protect and defend the U.S. Constitution, laws, and flags, just like he did as a Marine Corps officer and state senator. Quote, "What is unconstitutional is the way that our federal government is abdicating their duties," Reichman said. "They refuse to enforce the laws. Our president took the same oath, and along with U.S. Customs and Borders, he has failed." The legislation moves to the House for further consideration. Turn to obituaries in the Fort Dodge Messenger. Jim W. Crouch, age 73, of Fort Dodge, passed away March 4 at the Trinity Regional Medical Center. Funeral services, Monday, March 11th, in the chapel of the Loffersweiler Funeral Home at 2 p.m. Visitation, also at the funeral home, will take place on Sunday from 2 to 5 p.m. In other notices, we have Stephen Strom of Plattsmouth, age 75, passed away February 29. Private services will be held at the Omaha National Cemetery. Alberta Anderson of Eagle Grove, visitation Saturday, March 9, 12 to 2 p.m. at the Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove. Merle Anderson of Eagle Grove, visitation Saturday, March 9, 12 to 2 p.m. at the Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove. And Annie Avery of Belmont, age 92, passed away Wednesday, March 6th. Ewing Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Time for sports. On the front page of the sports section, it shows a photo of a young lady holding a state tournament trophy high. And the title, or the caption, is Abby Capacius walks off the court with the state tournament trophy for Bishop Garrigan. A handful of area basketball players were named All-State by the Iowa Girls Coaches Association. Earning first-team honors in Class 1A were Newell Fonda teammates Kiara Junkers and McKenna Sievers, along with Bishop Garrigan's Abby Capacius. Junkers and Sievers led the Mustangs to their 8th runner-up trophy at state this past weekend, while Capacius helped the Golden Bears qualify for the Elite 8 for a 5th consecutive season. Kinsey Hinders of Newell Fonda made the second team, and Gracelyn Eastman from Bishop Garrigan was on the third. In 3A, Algona's Laura McLaughlin made the second team, and Humboldt's Morgan Mann made the second team in 4A. Players selected All-District in 1A include Junkers, Hinders, Sievers, Capacius. Genevieve Ami of Pocahontas area was named in 2A, with McLaughlin making the 3A team and Mann the 4A squad. Fort Dodge's Destiny Phillips from St. Edmunds and Maya Neverman and Webster City's Jolie Stewart were honored with the E. Wayne Cooley You Can Award, which goes to players who illustrate the qualities of determination, character, and the values of pursuing victory with honors. And a little more girls. All TLC girls announced. Kiara Junkers and McKenna Sievers helped the Newell Fonda girls to a perfect 11-0 record and another Twin Lakes Conference title this past season. Both were among those players named to the All-League First Team. The Mustangs reached the Class 1A finals, placing second for an 8th time. And speaking of time, we're out of time for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Thursday, March 7th, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with disabilities. It's been my pleasure to read for you today. Have a great day. Thank you.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay! Ready.
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing. It really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.